From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a New England sports fan of a certain age, chances are you can describe exactly what happened during Game 6 of the 1986 World Series when Bill Buckner missed a roller at first.
Little roller up along first, behind the bag, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight and the Mets win it!
That error allowed the Mets a winning run and further cemented the curse of the Bambino in the minds of Red Sox fans. Many of those same fans still get weepy when thinking of 2004, when the Sox finally reversed the curse and won the World Series. But along with the swells of pride comes the agony. Just ask any Bruins fan who watched Boston's 2-1 lead in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals squandered by two Blackhawks goals in the last 76 seconds of the game. Sorry. Too soon? We spoke to science writer and Radiolab contributor Eric Simmons before the Bruins' crushing defeat. Eric's latest book, The Secret Lives of Sports Fans, is his attempt to figure out the science and psychology of those whose passion for sports quickly tips into fanaticism. And it begins with his own play-by-play of a heartbreak.
In order to really explain this to people, you need to understand how painful and how miserable this is. And this is a very easy memory for me to select because this is like 6 years later now. And this still, I'm like shaking in the studio now because it still agitates me. So I'm sitting there in the California Memorial Stadium in Berkeley, which is this beautiful stadium, you know, just this great view across the bay. And it's in Strawberry Canyon. It's a gorgeous place. And my beloved Cal football team, which I have been going to games since I was 4 months old. My dad dragged me out there on his shoulders. We are watching the number two ranked team in the country, our team, which has never won anything. Like, they're always just falling short, or, you know, they haven't been to the Rose Bowl since the 1950s. They haven't won the Rose Bowl since like the 1930s or something. This is one of those things that, you know, you just never quite expect to happen in your lifetime. I'm sure everybody in the New England area like is like, oh yeah, I've been there.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting there and our team is ranked number two and the number one team has lost. And they are playing a pretty poor game against a not very good team, but they're coming back and they make this inspired comeback. And this place is just going nuts. Like, everybody is standing and they're driving down the field with like 10 seconds left. The ball's on the 8-yard line. This is so manifest that they are going to score and win this game and be the number one ranked team in the country. And this thing that we've been longing for is going to happen. And they screw it up. Just like out of nowhere, they screw it up in the worst possible way, where like the most obvious thing that the 18-year or 19-year-old quarterback, he's a kid and he makes a bad decision. And like, yeah, of course, like 19-year-olds make bad decisions sometimes, but he makes a bad decision and we just lose it. How does this happen? And you can talk to anybody who was there or anybody who was watching, and we all have this just like, oh my God, it was like the most painful thing ever. And I remember him screwing up and they lose the game by 3 points, even though they were right there and they should have not lost. And the coach is throwing his headset on the ground because it's just like this normally placid guy has lost it too. And everybody is standing there and I'm standing there with my hands on my head, just jaw dropped in horror. And then I remember after the game, going into San Francisco, and it's probably, you know, about dinner time for a fashionably late dinner, and everybody on the train's kind of dressed up, and they're going for cocktails, and just, you know, it's the San Francisco food scene, and it's dressy and classy, and I'm sitting here, and I'm, like, crammed in the corner of the train, and I'm wearing my Cal hat, which after, like, 4 hours starts to, like, restrict my head, and my head's been pulsing anyway because of all the excitement, and so I'm just sitting there, like, with a headache, and I had for dinner, like, a boiled hot dog, and all these people are all dressed up, and it's like, what is wrong with me? So there's where the book comes from.
Well, you describe this kind of feeling, like, you know, that rises within us of, you know, like, yeah. I don't know, erupting outside of us. And I wonder, do you have any comparisons to that emotion? Is any other equivalency in your life?
Not in my life. I mean, I think this is one of the puzzling things for me is that I don't write about sports very often. I usually write about the environment and nature and these kind of things. I love hiking and the outdoors. And I think of myself as this fairly calm person. And I have a very calm kind of relationship. And then I go to things like this and I just lose it. And it feels like I'm possessed. It's not even me anymore. It's this, you know, insane demon raging beast going on in there. And so that's what I just puzzles me to no end. And so that's where I went.
Well, you find that actually has a lot to do with what's going on in the endocrine system of a super fan. What's happening in the body of a sports fanatic?
This is really kind of amazing. You have all these hormones changing all the time in response to life. But one of the things it looks like is that your hormones, and in particular in men, your testosterone, is responding to this game as if you were actually playing in it. There's pretty good evidence that when you win a competition of any kind, you know, you win a game of chess, your testosterone will go up. And there's pretty good evidence that if you lose a competition, your testosterone will go down. I mean, this has been studied all up and down animals, not just people. But the idea that not just me competing, but me watching other people compete when I'm not involved at all. I mean, I don't know any of these kids. I don't know any of the players who play professionally. I probably wouldn't like them if I did know them. But all the same, my testosterone probably is going up when they win, and it's probably depressed when they lose, not through anything I control. And, you know, if you know a little bit about testosterone, it's tied to increased aggression, kind of, you know, increased belligerence, you might say. It's very much a kind of dominance in social hormone. And this is going up without your ability to control it, just because you're watching other people's testosterone going up, really, to me, is kind of remarkable.
Eric Simmons is with us. His new book is called The Secret Lives of Sports Fans. And it's his attempt to get at the root of fandom, this sometimes enlivening, sometimes appalling display of irrational behavior around sports. Now, this isn't just happening in the endocrine system. It also affects us neurologically. Tell us about the role that mirror neurons play.
One thing I was really interested in is this feeling that all sports fans have about anticipation. And a lot of, you know, when, oh, my God, I knew that was going to happen. Those guys always blow it. Well, a lot of that is obviously hindsight bias. But some of it appears to be not. And it gets at kind of the heart of this reaction we're having in our brain in these really quite incredible little neurons that they've discovered in the last 15 or so years called mirror neurons. And these are, they argue, kind of the root of a lot of our empathy and our understanding of other people. And what they see in them is that they turn on whether we are conducting an action ourselves, whether we're planning and engaging in action, whether we are watching someone else do the action, whether we're just reading about the action, it seems, when we just hear the word for the action, we are having these same neurons turn on. And so the argument that extends from this is that when we see someone else do something, we don't need to think about it to understand what they want, to understand what they're doing. We can see someone kick a soccer ball. I can see someone hit a hockey puck. And I can instantly understand, because I'm running this simulation in my brain of exactly what I would do if I were hitting the hockey puck, if I were kicking the soccer ball. There's a pretty good study of basketball players, and they talk about rebounds, and the advantage that professional basketball players have is their ability to anticipate a shot that's going to be missed before it's even in the air, because they can read the body language so well of the other player, of the shooter, that they know this is going to miss. And there's a big competitive advantage to having good mirror neurons in basketball, because you can go get this rebound. And so I kind of applied that to a lot of sports where you're anticipating something, where you see the action. And this, I mean, this applies in part to why we emote so much around sports, because we really deeply understand what's happening.
But how about heartbreak? How about pride? Why do we stick with teams that keep breaking our hearts?
Right. This is my favorite question of all. I think it really does actually parallel love. You know, there are bad breakups where you look back and there were still rewarding moments in there. And a lot of the end of a season is for most people, is kind of a bad breakup with the team. It's like, we're done now for 3 months or 4 months or the off season. You know, I talk about Cleveland quite a bit in the book, because that's the place where you ask this question of why do you come back when you know that these things are challenging your self-control, when you know that this is going to change your testosterone and your empathy and your group behavior, and you still come back. Well, what's the reward? And, you know, for people whose teams have won recently or who are going to win, you know, well, it's obviously what the reward is. It makes you happy. But for the people whose teams don't win, well, there's got to be some other reward out there that means something to us. And that's exactly it. this is actually a really good source of identity for people that is more important in some sense than just the happiness you get from winning and losing, that my ability to say I'm a Cleveland Indians fan is really important to me. And that makes it worth sticking with the losing. That makes all the little testosterone and the depression and the frustration makes it worth it. And the ability to kind of be in this loving relationship and have your identity protected by the Indians and be in love with them makes up for a lot of heartbreak.
I'm wondering, Eric Simmons, with the piece of your soul belonging to the San Jose Sharks, did working on this book actually help you regain any free will over your fandom writing this book?
No. No, I'm just as hopeless as ever. I think I went into the book a little bit mad that these guys have such power over me. And I think that understanding a little bit kind of where the power comes from and understanding that really, even in the frustration, there's good stuff in there. You know, that's important in every relationship. It's important in most of your jobs to understand that there's going to be some level of frustration and you have to figure out what's meaningful about it and just work with that. And I think I've moved into that stage of my relationship with the Sharks. They fail me every year. I deal with it. But I understand what I get out of them and that they do bring me some happiness and joy along the way and some meaning. So I appreciate that is what I'm telling you.
Eric Simmons, new book is called The Secret Lives of Sports Fans. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
Now, you can find more on this title and Eric's previous book, which is Darwin Slept Here, at wordofmouthradio.org. So, hockey fans, did the Bruins' loss in Game 6 make your top 5 list of heartbreaking moments? We made our own list with some help from Eric Simmons. You can take a look at it and let us know if your gut-wrencher made the cut. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. And Word of Mouth fans, we try never to disappoint and promise not to break your heart when Word of Mouth moves to a new time starting next Monday, July 1st. We're going to be on at 2 o'clock, right between here and now, and Fresh Air. Same playbook, different time. Coming up, Sean Hurley goes panning for gold when Word of Mouth continues.